The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Good morning. Good morning and welcome. My name is Ruth Palmer, and you're in the seminar on nurturing the emotional and spiritual health of adolescent girls and young women. My husband was in a band in high school, and their motto was, if you can't be good, be loud. And then when he got older, it was, if you can't be good, be high tech. And so I'm following in these footsteps and hoping all of this works. Let's start with a word of prayer. We thank you, our God, for the opportunity to meet and just to discuss this very important topic. We pray that you give us wisdom in nurturing the girls that are in our lives, that we would learn something today and take something with us that we could put into practice. And I pray that the words of my mouth and the meditation of our heart will be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. Well, as you know, I'm a psychologist in practice with Diane Langberg and Associates, and probably half of my caseload are teens, and a large portion of those are girls. And so I want to start off by telling you about a couple of these girls, four stories. Four young women in their teens and early 20s, and these are all true stories, and I've changed the names and some details, of course, to protect their privacy. As you listen, I want you to think about what these four girls might have in common. First is Debbie. She's a 21-year-old who dropped out of Christian college because she was experiencing nightmares and persistent memories of physical and sexual abuse. During her high school years, she lived with a pastor and his family here in the States. Her parents are missionaries overseas. For the 2.5 years she lived with the family, the father repeatedly beat her with belts and sexually molested her. She didn't tell her parents. It was a college house parent that she finally confided in, and this woman helped her get into counseling. Today, she struggles with the will to live. She's been hospitalized 3 times for cutting her wrists, and she has nightmares on an almost daily basis, and intrusive memories, and she often cuts herself. And she tells me it's a way of making the pain go away. Lori is a 16-year-old who traces her struggles with body image to elementary school. She told me, when I was in grade school, I went to a Christian school, and there the kids used to tease me about being too fat. I was always a little chunky. By junior high, she became very self-conscious about her body. She assumed that the failed romances of adolescence had to do with her being too fat. She began exercising and dieting. Today she eats about 500 calories a day, exercises compulsively. She smokes to control her weight. And she won't eat any food with fat at all, any fat in it at all. She's very phobic. And she does what we call purging. She uses laxatives, diuretics, and self-induced vomiting whenever she feels too fat. She's had problems with her menstrual cycle and with depression and with perfectionism. She constantly asks me if I think she's too fat. And in reality, she's tall, she's fit, and she's beautiful. And then there's Karen, an 18-year-old senior who was an A student on the swim team and in the band in junior high. In senior high, her grades began slipping. She gave up swimming in the band, and now she's barely passing, and she argues with her parents about whether she'll go to college. Last year, she got a nose ring without their permission, and recently she showed me a 3-inch-long tattoo on her back that she has not yet shown her parents. Her most frequent phrase about life is, whatever. Recently, she was diagnosed with genital herpes. And finally, there's Amy. who was date raped in high school. She didn't tell her parents about it because she hadn't gotten permission to go out with the guy in the first place, and so she feared their reaction. She dealt with the rape by doing and being an achieving good girl. She did very well in high school and didn't fight with her parents, even when the younger sister was arguing with them over curfews and cleaning the room. She went off to Christian college and studied social work. There she dated on and off, and in her senior year she became serious with a guy named Brad, not his real name. They talked of getting married. There were problems, however. Brad was very possessive. They fought a lot. They broke up several times. Several times he would follow her around on campus and try and convince her to talk with him. Several times he grabbed her and wouldn't let her go until she talked with him. She finally broke up with him for good, and he continued to pursue her. He called her constantly. Finally, one day he called her and was crying and said he had repented. He needed someone to talk to. He had no friends. Would she please come over? She felt sorry for him, and she went to his apartment. Once inside, he locked the door, and he threw her on the couch and raped her. She was numb. She blamed herself for being so stupid. How could this happen again? She didn't tell her parents until she found out she was pregnant a month later. They agreed to help her raise the child because she wanted to keep the baby, even though it was conceived in such an ugly way. She dropped out of college 3 months before graduation because she couldn't tolerate seeing Brad on campus. She had gone to the officials at school, but they didn't believe that it was rape. In fact, the campus was divided into two sides, some believing her and some believing him. And this really was intolerable to her. She couldn't tolerate all these people believing that she had willingly consented to having sex with this guy because she had such high moral standards and her only two sexual experiences had been coerced upon her. She didn't come to counseling until 4 months later when she lost the baby. She came with grief, she was having trouble sleeping, and she was constantly afraid. Now, I could have told you about Sandy, whose mother was an alcoholic and her father agoraphobic, or Julie, whose mother died last year unexpectedly, or Robin, whose father sexually abused her from age 8 to 18. But we would understand why these young women are struggling with depression, eating disorders, and post-traumatic stress symptoms. But what about Debbie and Lori and Karen and Amy? What they have in common is that they all come from middle-class, suburban, Christian homes. They all have two parents that love them. So what's going on that these girls and young women are in such trouble? This question is what prompted me to do this seminar. I have been seeing more and more of this in my practice, and I've been bewildered and frustrated. I've had many questions. Why are so many girls in therapy in the 1990s? For every young male I see in counseling, there's five females. Why are there more girls who self-mutilate? What is the meaning of lip, nose, eyebrow, and not to mention other body part piercings? Why are sex and drugs so common in junior high school? Why do girls not know how to protect themselves? Why do so many girls hate their parents or feel they can't go to them when they're in trouble? I decided to discuss girls specifically for three reasons. First is the greater number of girls that I see in an outpatient practice where I work. Previously, I worked at a school for delinquent kids, where some of you work now, and there, adolescent boys predominated. Is that still true? I think boys also face unique pressures and are vulnerable to somewhat different problems than girls, and that could merit a seminar in its own right, maybe next year. And this afternoon in the Parenting Adolescents seminar, my colleague Phil and I will focus on some general issues to both sexes, but in this seminar I wanted to focus on girls. The second reason is the seriousness of the problems I'm seeing in girls in greater and greater numbers. Girls seem to be especially vulnerable to three kinds of problems. The first are mood difficulties, including depression, self-mutilation and suicidality. The second is disturbed body image, including dangerous eating and weight control patterns. And then the third is hazardous sexual experiences, including sexual abuse and date rape, sexually transmitted diseases, and pregnancy. And finally, the third reason I decided to focus on girls is that I'm puzzled by the vulnerability of girls despite having intact, reasonably healthy families. When I was working at the alternative school, I was used to seeing the effects of dysfunctional families on kids. But I always expected that coming from a good family would buffer many of the problems that adolescents face during that life stage. But what I see happening now is beyond the realm of family life and is putting teens at risk, especially girls. I've talked to parents about their frustrations, particularly junior high seems like a crucible. Many confident, well-adjusted girls were transformed into sad and angry failures. Parents mourned for their carefree, uninhibited, achieving little girls that their daughters were in elementary school. They didn't understand what was happening. They had raised their daughters to be assertive and confident, and instead their girls seemed insecure and overly concerned with their femininity. They missed the daughters who sang in the kitchen, who read school papers, who went with them on fishing trips and to ball games. They missed the daughters who liked to bake cookies, to play Pictionary, and be kissed goodnight. Many parents blame themselves. They feel shut out, impotent, and misunderstood. They often attribute the difficulties of this time to their daughters or to their own failings. They struggled with how to encourage their daughters to be independent and autonomous and still keep them safe. How could they encourage their daughters to take on the world when that world included drug pushers and date rapists? This seminar is my attempt to make sense of some of these questions, to explore why girls are having more trouble now than when my friends and I were adolescents. Many of us hated our teen years, and I wouldn't go back for a minute, but significantly fewer of us developed eating disorders, were suicidal, cut ourselves, or ran away. I want to talk about what's going on when kids from healthy families get sick emotionally and spiritually. And we'll start by exploring some of the cultural forces that I think are poisoning girls. And then we'll end with a focus on some strategies parents and others can use to help strengthen girls so they'll be ready to face the challenges of the 90s. First, some of the cultural forces. Most pre-adolescent girls are great to be around. They love everything: books, sports, nature, people, music, art. Almost all the heroines of girls' literature come from this age group: Anne of Green Gables, Heidi, Pippi Longstocking. Girls of this age are not yet burdened with the female role. They can be tomboys, a word that connotes confidence, competence, and courage. They can climb trees, make mud pies, play with dolls, or run a race. They can read books voraciously, generate great science projects, and compete at math. They're free to act without worrying if their behavior is feminine or masculine. Then something happens in early adolescence. Studies show girls' IQ scores drop. Their math and science grades plummet in junior high. They lose their resiliency and optimism, become less curious, and less inclined to take risks. They report being very self-conscious and unhappy with their bodies, how they look, and what they feel their bodies are capable of doing. They feel less competent athletically than they did in elementary school. Even the speech of girls at this age becomes more hesitant. Let me give you some examples. Listen for some common phrases. I'm sure you've heard them. The interview asks 14-year-old Anna, "What is society's image of the ideal woman?" She answers, "Someone who could be successful and happy with what they're doing. I don't know. It depends on what you think about society. I mean, because there's all kinds of people, they can each have different thoughts." Or Lisa, age 13, is asked what stands out for her over the past year. "I don't know, probably grades." "Why are grades so important to you?" the interviewer asks. I don't know. It's for me and for my parents, and so I try to do well so that, I don't know, for my future, you know, for my parents, so that they're not disappointed. I don't know, for a lot of reasons. Or Judy, whose father recently remarried. It was really tense, like the whole summer, because everyone was trying to be extra special, nice to people, like the whole time. My stepmother, I was trying to be really nice to her. I don't know, because we all feel awkward. And by the end, we were tired of being nice. Everyone blew up, and we got in, like, huge fights. What did you hear?
I don't know.
You know. I mean, like. The same girl who boldly asserted her opinions in grade school punctuates her conversations now with I don't know. Even her intonation changes. Her statements go up at the end, as if perpetually asking a question. Unsure of her opinions now. I ask a girl how her weekend went. I had this project and I didn't get it done on time and I was in trouble because it was Sunday and it was due like the next day and it was time for my bedtime and like I told my sister and she told my mom and that got me in trouble. You know, my mom yelled and so I started working on it. I finally got it done, but it was past midnight. Sound like your daughters? One writer described this transformation as girls who were the subjects of their own lives became the objects of others' lives. Let me repeat that. Girls who were the subjects of their own lives became the objects of others' lives. Adolescent girls experience a conflict between their inner selves and their need to be feminine, between their status as human beings and their vocation as females. They stop thinking, who am I? What do I want? And start thinking, what must I do to please others? More specifically, what must I do to attract boys? Adolescence is when girls experience pressure to put aside their authentic selves and to display only a small portion of their gifts. This pressure disorients and depresses most girls. It's my belief that this pressure does not come from parents, not usually, but from the culture. Most parents want their daughters to be strong, confident, and achieving. But something specific is happening in our culture that's producing the high rates of suicide attempt, eating disorders, and early sexuality and pregnancy among adolescent girls. The Centers for Disease Control report the suicide rate among children aged 10 to 14 rose 75% between 1979 and 1988. And suicide is the second leading cause of death in young people ages 15 to 24, followed only, I think, by accidents, automobile accidents. Though the suicide rate for boys is 2 to 3 times greater than for girls due to the lethal means that they choose, girls have a much higher suicide attempt rate, apparently a desperate means of asking for help. Females are more often diagnosed with adolescent depression than males, and this is a change from childhood when it's evenly dispersed. Depression seems to be evenly dispersed among boys and girls. Half of all teenage girls are dieting. 1 in 5 has an eating disorder. Of all the people diagnosed with eating disorders, 95 to 98% are female. Since the late 1960s, adolescents have become sexually active in greater numbers and at younger ages. From a national longitudinal survey, it showed that by age 15, about 17% of boys and 6% of girls are no longer virgin. By age 18, 67% of boys and 44% of girls are sexually experienced. And by age 20, the figures go up for 80% for males and 70% for females. During the past several decades, while marital childbearing has decreased, non-marital childbearing has increased dramatically for adolescents. In 1985, 13% of all babies were born to teenagers, 3/5 of whom were unmarried. Each year, 1 in 10 girls becomes pregnant, 50% of whom will carry their babies to term, resulting in 1 million babies per year. Though there's been a decrease in the pregnancy rate for ages 16 to 19, there's been an increase in ages 10 to 15. Girls in this age group are 5 times more likely to get pregnant than the same age girls in other developed countries. So what's going on in this culture that makes girls vulnerable to such grave problems in adolescence? I want to start by analyzing some of the messages girls hear in our culture. We're going to talk about movies, TV, music, and magazines. A few years ago, my husband and I went to see Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. I think we were the only 2 over 20 in the packed movie theater. One thing I remember is that every time a female walked into the scene, I don't know if you've all seen this, but Bill or Ted went like this, swing, indicating they had an erection because she was such a babe. I was disturbed by this. I mean, it was supposedly funny. But I was asking myself, what are the girls in this movie theater and the boys learning about the value of women from this movie? Then there was the movie Medicine Man, the story of a male scientist who's working in the rainforest searching for a cure for cancer. Sean Connery is visited by a female scientist, 40 years his younger, wearing short shorts and a tight low-cut blouse. He's shocked to find the scientist is female, and he refuses to work with her. She's snooty and terrified of snakes. Then she has an accident. He saves her, and she falls weeping into his arms, a helpless blob of jelly. After that, she becomes more feminine and likable. She follows Sean around, and he rewards her with smiles and caresses, and in the end, she gives up her career to help him find a cure for cancer. Now, these movies are mild. Others, like Mermaids, depict a teenage girl having graphic sex with a 26-year-old guy she barely knows. Or the scores of film that couple violence with sex, The Fatal Attractions, The Silence of the Lambs, and the slasher films, Halloween 1 to 80, Friday the 13th 1 to 55. Even the plot for romance movies is different. In the 50s, people met, argued, fell in love, then kissed. In the 70s, people met, argued, fell in love, then had sex. By the 90s, people meet, have sex, argue, and then maybe fall in love. Television isn't much help either. The average teen watches 21 hours of TV a week, compared with 5.8 hours on homework and 1.8 hours reading. On the screen, girls see women mainly depicted as half-clad and half-witted, often awaiting rescue by quick-thinking, fully clothed men. Television almost never features old, heavy, or unattractive women. And even if a woman is a scholar or a scientist, she usually looks like a Playboy bunny. Women are often portrayed as victims of violence. Lots of plots have to do with women being raped, beaten, chased, or terrorized by men. Often sex and violence are fused in television and movie plots. TV ads are the worst. Women's bodies sell almost anything: suntan lotion, tires, tractors, cars, and liquor. What message does your daughter get when she sees the Swedish bikini teen parachute in to fulfill the sexual fantasies of beer-drinking men? Women are portrayed as expensive toys, as the ultimate recreation for men. They are the object of someone else's lives instead of the subject of their own lives. In 1988, an exhaustive study by Lou Harris and associates found that in the prime afternoon and evening hours, the 3 largest networks broadcast a total of more than 65,000 sexual references every year. This means hourly averages of 27 instances of sexual content. The study determined that the average TV watcher now views about 14,000 references to sex in the course of a year. In addition to the spectacular increase in the amount of erotic activity in prime time, the context in which that behavior occurs has shifted dramatically. Prior to 1969, references to sex outside of marriage turned up in about only one out of 30 shows. More recently, such references occur in about one out of six, and the ratio continues to narrow. Sex outside of marriage is portrayed as normal, even for teens. For example, the 1991 season ender of Beverly Hills 90210 showed 17-year-old Brenda losing her virginity to Dylan, a guy she knew for 3 months. 14-year-old Blossom debated going to second base with her boyfriend. One of her friends tells her, "Seems like yesterday we started wearing bras, and here we are talking about taking them off." Roseanne takes her 16-year-old daughter to the gynecologist so she can get her on birth control pills. Later, she discovers her daughter's already been having sex. Roseanne's sister applauds Roseanne's willingness to facilitate the girl's sex life. Isn't it great, Roseanne, that Becky has such a progressive, open-minded mom that she can talk to about that? When Roseanne moans, "She's all grown up, Jackie. She doesn't need me anymore," her sister reassures you, "Of course she needs you. She needs you to pay for the pills." Even Doogie Howser lost his virginity. He celebrated his 18th birthday by going to bed with his girlfriend. A man is a lot of things, but he is not a virgin, the deep-thinking Doogie philosophizes before his big night. "Being a virgin is driving me nuts. It's beginning to affect my work as a doctor." Fortunately, one of his close friends is willing to help Dr. Howser with his embarrassing problem. He hands out condoms to Doogie and declares, "Tonight, we are men." A recent episode of Friends, a very popular show among middle school girls these days, depicts Rachel and Ross finally consummating their long-awaited romance. The couple has sex at a museum where Ross works. The next morning, they awaken naked in one of the exhibits, only to find a group of school children looking on. This is one of the favorite shows of teenage girls. Perhaps most damaging is the glorification of sexual adventurism and the focus on physical pleasure as an end in itself. This theme is exploited by every element in the popular culture, but it is nowhere more powerfully expressed than in the music business. Unfortunately, there's no way to decently discuss contemporary music. If you're unfamiliar with the messages in today's music, be prepared to be appalled. But I want to expose you to some material that's readily available to and regularly ingested by the average teenager in America. Consider, for example, the popular 1980s group Guns N' Roses. Their 1987 album, Appetite for Destruction, sold more than 12 million copies in the U.S. alone, enough for nearly half the teenagers in the country to own one. And given the natural tendency of kids to share their music with one another, it means that the overwhelming majority of American adolescents have now been exposed to the following poetry. Or as a tender alternative, and then their 1991 album offered more of the same. These songs have nothing to do with romance of even the most fleeting variety, but rather have everything to do with violent hostility toward women. This theme is more explicit in rap music, and I'll not expose you to that because some of it is so perversely cruel it makes me sick to even read it. But it's not confined only to heavy metal and rap. One of the most preferred new performers in the alternative genre, which is very popular among middle-class whites, is a young woman named Alanis Morissette. Her recent album, Jagged Little Pill, won a Grammy this year and was named Album of the Year. In her hit song, You Oughta Know, she sings about being dumped by her boyfriend for another woman. In this song, she holds up to the teen audience being perverted as a standard for sexual behavior. Specifically, in the first verse, she's singing about performing oral sex in a theater. She's the most frequently cited favorite singer of the girls in our youth group, particularly the junior high girls. Then there's Courtney Love, the widow of Kurt Cobain, rock idol considered by a martyr to many, who killed himself 2 years ago. She's the lead singer of an all-female band descriptively entitled Hole, H-O-L-E. I'm gonna pass this around. In her 1992 album, Pretty on the Inside, Courtney shrieks out lyrics about her experiences turning tricks as a teenage whore. These photos are from a March 1996 edition of YM Young and Modern magazine, whose audience is preteen and teenage girls. Some leading pop groups may use language that's more polite, but the messages they send are no less depraved. The visual images of rock videos can be just as corrupt. Whether it's Madonna dressed as a peep show performer singing Open Your Heart to a frightened but fascinated 11-year-old boy, encouraging him to join the middle-aged patrons who are watching her strip, or the 1991 Michael Jackson video, Black or White, where he repeatedly grabs at his crotch, pulls his zipper up and down suggestively, and then the video climaxes when Jackson picks up a garbage can to shatter a store window and uses a crowbar to savagely bust up a car for no apparent reason at all. Supposedly, the video was about racial harmony. These are mild. I mean, some of the rap videos are. Such violent and degrading images would be distasteful in any context, but they're particularly objectionable in relation to the target audience to which they're addressed. The average viewer of music videos is between 14 and 16 years of age. In analyzing the content of the videos that appeal so powerfully to these adolescents and featured round the clock on MTV, the National Coalition on TV Violence found that 68% of them contained at least one of the following elements: explicit violence, suggestions of violence, sexually suggestive themes, profanity, smoking, and/or alcohol consumption. At least in terms of the personalities these musicians project to their young audiences, they are remarkably one-dimensional characters, ruled entirely by sexual and/or aggressive impulses. Life is nothing more than an endless series of conquests and seductions, occasionally interrupted by naked rage at the opposite sex. Consider what our children learn from contemporary music about what it means to be a man or what it means to be a woman and how one should treat the other. The change that we see in music is that innuendo has been replaced by with such graphic lyrics and images that even preteens are getting the message. The same kids you have to fight with to memorize facts for a test know the lyrics to these songs inside and out. We see this in youth group. We'll sing some popular songs that are as wholesome as we can find. And kids will get upset if we get a word out of order, if we don't pause in the right place. Junior high kids. The influence of music was brought home to me 2 years ago when I did play therapy with an 8-year-old girl. Her favorite activity was to pretend that she was performing a music video, and she'd use my office tape recorder to record her video, and I was her audience. Her favorite video to perform was Janet Jackson's song, If. This little 8-year-old girl would sing, "If I was your woman, the things I'd do for you, well, I'm not, so I won't," while she'd dance around seductively. At 8 years old, she had already been trained for the female role of being the object of someone else's desires, rather than the subject of her own life. Teen magazines are a good example of the training in appearance obsession girls receive. The models in the magazines all look 6 feet tall and anorexic. The emphasis is on makeup, fashion, and weight. Girls are encouraged to diet and to spend money in order to develop looks that will attract boys. And apparently attracting boys is the sole purpose of life, because the magazines have no articles on careers, hobbies, politics, or academic pursuits. The message that is preached is, don't worry about feeling good or being good. Worry about looking good. I just want to read you the cover of a couple of these magazines, and then I'll pass them around to you. This is a Young and Modern, 1996. First we have Tiffany, who's TV star. Tiffany's Secret, How to Survive a Breakup. Love Talk, Get Him to Gush. Want a Makeover, We Can Help. Online Horror, We Met and He Raped Me. Get the Hair, Guys Worship. Find Love Now, The 6 New Guy Types, Snag Yours. Quiz, Are You Meant to Be Together? The Right Way to Ask Him Out. Prom Bliss, Your Complete Guide. Speaking of proms, Young and Modern also produced a prom special. Your Love Horoscope, It's Crucial. What Guys Really Want on Prom Night? Hair, 10 Hot New Styles, Perfect Makeup, A Step-by-Step Guide, 125 Prom Looks. Pass those around. Here's another, this is 17. Advertisements predominate in these magazines. In a recent issue of Teen Magazine, 1/3 of the pages contained ads, while in 17, nearly half were ads. In each, the vast majority, I went through and counted them, the vast majority of them were ads to improve one's appearance. Shampoo, makeup, jewelry, diets. Then there's the articles that are really ads. Here in Teen Magazine, we have an article ostensibly called Problem Solvers. Got a beauty problem? Don't freak. Coming up, beauty repair for your skin, nails, and hair. It goes down several pages here on all the different beauty problems and, of course, the products that you'll need to serve them, to solve them. Hair and nails. Particularly insidious, I think, are the diet ads. And I want to show you a couple of these. Well, the empty promises are one thing, but I think particularly insidious is the motivation for it. Let's see here. Maybe the best sign that you're growing sleeker and sexier is the looks from guys who never noticed you before and the jealous looks from the competition. Look down below here. This is a real treat. Check here for guaranteed privacy. Yes, send my TBR system in a plain, unmarked package. So they can get this stuff and you don't even know what it is. Then there are the ads that help sell products to help a girl get a guy. There we go. Here's just some of the exciting things you'll learn. How to make him notice you without being pushy. Watch him come to you. How to make the first move so he can't say no. It works every time. How to get him to ask you out and how to ask him out. Hey, it's the 90s. The big mistake every girl makes and how to avoid it. You'll never do this again. How to make him want you more than any other girl, no matter what you look like. The 5 little tricks to get any guy hooked. And again, we have down the bottom, yes, I'm tired of being alone. I've waited long enough. I want a gorgeous guy of my own. Rush me now to get him system. I must be completely satisfied or I'll return it for a full refund. Note, for your privacy, the get him system will be sent to you in a sealed, unmarked package. And finally are the ads that combine dieting with getting a guy. This one's just awful. This one is the story of a woman who was married, but she was overweight. 2 years ago, Bernie went out for a paper and never came back. He did leave a note on the fridge and a week later filed for divorce. What's the message here? If you're too fat, you will be abandoned. I went to my doctor for help. She lost weight. Since I've become thin, my life has changed totally. I quit smoking. I have a good job. I love to shop for nice clothes, and I'm in control again.
That statement right there is particularly chilling, because a lot of girls who get into anorexic behavior, they do it for control. They think they've reduced their whole life to their weight. And if they can control their weight, it simplifies the complexities of their entire life. It's reduced to weight. The standards of beauty promoted in these magazines are usually unattainable without being sick physically and emotionally. I want to pass around one such picture of this beauty standard. What girls really look like this? Look at the girl in the middle, especially. The beauty standards in our culture have changed dramatically. In 1951, for example, Miss Sweden was 5'7", 151 pounds. In 1983, Miss Sweden was 5'9", and 109 pounds. That's 2 inches taller than me and about 20 pounds lighter. This discrepancy between the ideal women of the media and real women is greater than ever. And it creates our plague of eating disorders. Girls compare their own bodies to women in the media and they find them wanting. Dieting and dissatisfaction with bodies have become normal reactions to puberty. Girls develop eating disorders when our culture developed a standard of beauty that they cannot obtain by being healthy. When unnatural thinness became attractive, girls started doing unnatural things to be thin, like starving themselves, compulsively exercising, taking diet pills, and purging by self-induced vomiting, laxative, and diuretic use. In all the years I've been working with teens, I have yet to meet a teenage girl who's happy with her body. In fact, I know very few adult women who are happy with their bodies. With puberty, girls face enormous cultural pressure to split into false selves. This pressure comes from schools, magazines, music, television, advertisements, and movies. It also comes from peers. Girls can be true to themselves and risk abandonment by their peers, or they can reject themselves and be socially acceptable. Most girls choose to be socially accepted and split into two selves, one that is authentic and one that is culturally scripted. In public, they become who they are supposed to be. Often parents are fighting very hard to save their daughters' true selves. They encourage their daughters to stay with their childhood interests and argue with them over dieting and dating and makeup and sexual activity. They encourage athletics and math and science classes. They dislike the media values and resist cultural definitions of their daughters as consumers or sex objects. They do not want their daughters to sell their souls for popularity. But the cultural pull is very powerful, and the price for nonconformity is very high. Girls who speak frankly are labeled as bitches. Girls who are not attractive are scorned. The rules are reinforced by the visual images in the media, by song lyrics, by casual remarks, by criticisms, by teasing, and by jokes. Junior high, in particular, is a harsh place. Kids who do not conform are scapegoated. I want to play you a song. This is the story of the price of one girl's nonconformity. It's by the Christian musician Randy Stonehill. And I want to play it to appeal to your other side of your brain, to get you on a feeling level, like a good psychologist. Okay. I cried the first time I heard it, too. Many girls complain about harassment in school. And while junior high boys have always teased girls about sex, the level of teasing is different. Girls are taunted about everything from oral sex to pubic hair, from periods to the imagined appearance of their genitals. The harassment that girls experienced in the 1990s is much different than when you and I were in junior high. The remarks are more graphic and mean-spirited, and it keeps many girls from wanting to go to school. Unfortunately, it is often other girls who rigidly enforce the norms with their sarcastic comments, condescending looks, and vicious gossip. A 14-year-old girl named Katie was brought to me about 2 months ago by her mother. They had been fighting over her attending school. She had written 2 suicide notes, one after her friends on the bus intercepted a note she had written to one of her girlfriends, which she had signed, "Love, Katie." She was teased mercilessly for weeks after that for being a lesbian. The other note was written about a guy that she liked that kids found out about. And I have the actual note here. "Mom, I'm sick of school. This girl in school asked me who I liked. I told her. She told her friend she knew who I liked. She asked me, and a bunch of people kept bugging me. Later, Tanya made me tell her, or she wouldn't give me my books. I don't trust her. She will tell everyone. I'm not going to school. I'll kill myself. How do you think it feels? Every day I think about suicide. Every day I go to school scared. Whether I fall going to or from the bus, I have a lot of pills upstairs, and I will take them all." And she signed this note, "No school." Girls have 4 general ways they react to cultural pressures to abandon themselves. They can conform, withdraw, be depressed, or get angry. Most girls react with some combination of these 4 ways. If the pain they feel is blamed on themselves and on their own failures, it manifests itself as depression. If it's blamed on others, on their parents or peers or the culture, it shows up as anger. This anger is often mislabeled as rebellion or even delinquency. And in fact, anger often masks a severe rejection of the self and an enormous sense of loss. Those that conform begin to deny their own hopes and gifts. They choose to be quiet in class rather than being called a brain. They choose to go with the popular crowd rather than the crowd they like. They choose to diet rather than eat when they're hungry. They choose to be polite rather than honest. They choose to be pretty rather than have fun. They choose to be liked by athletes rather than be an athlete. There's a deadness that comes from giving away too much of oneself for the approval of others. One girl put it this way: "You have to suffer to be beautiful." Now, we're all aware of this. You know, we've seen the National Geographic magazines of the, quote, primitive cultures that make people suffer for beauty, like this man in Irian Jaya with a bone through his nose, or this woman in Thailand who's had rings put on her neck since she was a little girl. And we, of course, we know the ancient history of foot binding. But what about in this culture? What are the ways that girls are taught to suffer for beauty? Ladies, can you think of any? You know them well.
High heels.
High heels. Mm-hmm. Anything else?
Corsets.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Wonder bras. Yes. Bras with bones in them. Eyebrow plucking. Shaving, or even worse, waxing one's legs.
Piercing.
Sleeping in curlers. Braces, breast implants, liposuction. I recently talked about this with Lori, the anorexic girl I told you about in the beginning. And when I asked her why females are willing to suffer, she said, "For the guys." And then she hesitated, and then she said, "And for other girls." I said, "Why for other girls?" And she said, "Well, you don't want some pretty girl looking at you and thinking you're disgusting."
a song. I'm going to play you another song, this time from popular culture. And this song, I think, also describes the deadness that girls feel from living with these expectations. And I think girls are attracted to this song more than for its catchy tune. It's very popular. I think it says something that resonates with their experiences. It's called "I'm Just a Girl." So what can we do about this to help girls feel like being just a girl isn't a death sentence, a curse? Parents used to help their children fit into culture. Now many parents fight against the cultural influences they know will harm their daughters. And I'd like to make several suggestions on how we can fight the forces that chip away at girls' health and wholeness. I'm going to start by showing just a small video clip regarding the factors that tend to prevent early sexuality. I think there are some good things in this tape that we can apply to broader issues beyond sexuality. It's just a few minutes. Well, we can't do anything about the timing of puberty. But I think some of the other issues can be influenced by parents and those who work with teens. And I'd like to distill these into three general ways to strengthen adolescent girls. The first general way I'm calling cultivating faith. It's no surprise that faith has an impact on kids' sexual values and behaviors. Studies also show that teens with strong religious commitment to be more resistant to drugs and delinquent behavior. I think this is so because a young person's faith fortifies four crucial developmental elements that influence behavior. The first being their identity, second being their self-esteem, the third being it provides them a sense of structure, and fourth being it provides them a sense of belonging. And each of these diminishes a girl's vulnerability to emotional distress and risky behaviors. In Christianity, kids are introduced to a God that loves them and forgives them. They belong to a community of fellow believers who seek to follow Christ and to serve others. There's meaning and purpose in loving God and neighbor. The Bible provides direction in decision-making regarding moral and ethical behavior. And there's joy and dignity in feeling that you have something to give to others. So how do we help kids know Christ and grow in their relationship with Him? First, we have to give them models of genuine faith. And this begins with parents, most assuredly. As their relationship with you becomes a template for how they perceive God. It also makes your faith, also makes following Christ credible. Your life is the most powerful witness to the reality of God. So we can't give kids something we don't have ourselves, and we can't expect them to resist the pressures of youth culture if they don't see us as different from our adult culture. I asked a 19-year-old why so many of his friends had rejected their faith in Christ, and he answered, because it was jammed down their throats and because they didn't see it do anything in their parents' lives. It is also important for teens to have other Christian role models. They're going through a natural process of questioning their parents' values in effort to develop greater autonomy, and this is good. But therefore, other adults are needed to fill the gap, to provide support, guidance, and reinforcement of wholesome values. Often teens will be more open with other adults than their own parents regarding questions about faith and morality. The Christian community can have great impact here. Whether it's the influence of Sunday school teachers, youth workers, or a teen's friends, parents, all can help cultivate faith by being mentors to developing adolescents. So, encourage your child's involvement in youth activities in Sunday school. Expose them to other family members or your friends who are Christians. Directly ask them to disciple your child. For example, many of the kids I see in counseling, they have conflicts with their parents, but it's it's tempered if they have a relationship with another family member. For example, a girl who's having horrible fights with her mom will go to her aunt's house when things get rough. And that aunt fills the gap for what's going on in the parent-child relationship. So, as an aunt, you can influence your niece's relationship with God and help your sibling as a parent by being available to spend time with your niece. This is especially important when tension rises with parents. The second means of cultivating faith is communication. Regularly engage teens in conversation of spiritual matters. Ask them what they're learning at church or what they think about a controversial moral issue. Kids love controversy. What questions do they have about their faith? What concerns that you could pray for them? And share what you believe, what you're learning, what God has done in your life, and your own prayer requests. By adolescence, kids' thinking has advanced, and they're capable of asking the big questions about life's meaning. It's crucial they have some discussions with you because popular culture is bombarding them with a cynical, depressing view of human existence. Back to the singer Alanis Morissette, she has a song called Ironic. The kids also love that one. And in it, the message is life stinks, bad things are going to happen, and even when good things happen, it's going to be too little too late. The line, the beginning of the song, it's like rain on your wedding day, it's a free ride when you've already paid. It's a real catchy song and the kids love it. Third, provide teens with opportunities for worship and service that are age appropriate. Most churches have junior church for little kids, but little attention is given to the worship needs of teenagers. We've taken a survey in our youth group. How many of them said it was boring? It's unanimous. Perhaps we need to support more efforts to incorporate worship forms that attract youth. Sermons that are youth-directed. Forms of music and musical instruments that are appealing to youth. And including teens more actively themselves in the church service. Another way is just to expose them to alternative music, Christian rock, for example, that has messages that are more wholesome than the popular music. For example, in June, our junior high youth will be going to Creation 96, sort of an outdoor Christian Woodstock. Urge your teen to go, to participate in these kinds of activities. Let them know there are good alternatives. Encourage and help finance kids' participation in service projects and mission trips. Teens today are very wrapped up in sports and band and school plays, which are all positive. But how many young people get to experience giving to others, like sharing their faith, feeding and housing the poor, visiting the sick, or helping the elderly? Worship and service are the means by which our faith is fleshed out, and we need more opportunities that are relevant and appealing to adolescents. Second general strategy I'm calling teaching resistance to the harmful messages of the culture. The first step here is just to be aware of what's going on. Think back when you were expecting your first child, those of you that are parents, how many books did you read on what to expect in the baby's first year? How much now are you exposing yourself to information on adolescent development or popular culture? Watch the shows your kids are watching. Listen to your daughter's music occasionally. Pick up her magazines. Familiarize yourself with the movies they're viewing. Your first line of teaching resistance to the junk values in the culture is to know where they are and where they're coming from to influence your teen. You need to view this as research and not as a lecture or criticizing, because they'll start hiding it from you. But see yourself as going into a foreign culture and gathering information. One good book I used in preparing the seminar was Michael Medved's Hollywood versus America. It's excellent. And another is entitled Reviving Ophelia, Saving the Selves of Adolescent Girls. This was an excellent book. I recommend it highly. A lot of what I've talked about today came from here. It's very compelling. She uses case studies She starts off with case studies and goes from the specific then to the broader issues. I'll have these up here. You can look at them afterwards. Another good one is our own Walt Mueller's Understanding Youth Culture. Here he goes through all the points of popular culture, and he also gives practical strategies for parents and youth workers. And there's also good books out there on adolescent development, textbook type, but there are good books out there that summarize. This one summarizes the role of puberty, of adolescent thinking, of popular culture, music, relationship with parents. I've also been told that Focus on the Family has a monthly publication for parents called Plugged In. It's a review of teen culture. We'll talk a little more about that teaching critical thinking. The second point of teaching resistance I'm calling predicting the pressures that they're going to face regarding drugs, sex, and appearance, and teach your daughter self-protection and protest. One of the ways you can do this is just by setting an example. Girls pick up on their parents' examples. They look at their parents' marriage as a model for relationships with the opposite sex. They listen for their parents' comments about appearance. They watch how their mothers handle food and weight issues. They listen to how their fathers define women. Fathers are very important to the developing girl. Girls are trying to figure guys out, and dads can really help. Staying close with your daughter by taking her out, continuing to show physical affection even when she looks more like a woman than a little girl, and keeping up with her life. Affirm more than her looks. Emphasize the skill she has. Encourage her to develop a healthy body rather than a gorgeous one. Offer to exercise with her. All these will help cultivate healthy self-esteem and buffer the appearance obsession and the tendency to look for love by having sex. The next one is along the lines of what we were just talking about. Teaching critical thinking skills by helping your daughter analyze the content of TV, ads, music, and films. You can't shut your teen off from the cultural messages entirely, and nor should you.
That's the question.
Yeah.
I'm looking at my husband saying, my daughter is so babied. She doesn't have these magazines. She's not allowed to watch Friends, which created a problem. You're saying Friends, and she doesn't watch it.
Yeah.
And I found out from Victoria the other day that one night when I was out, she watched it. She knows she's not allowed to watch it. She'll go watch. She watches Nickelodeon at night, and we watch the regular programs. She doesn't listen to music unless she listens to music at other people's houses. She doesn't listen to music. We have her so babied, and she's 11 and a half. I'm sitting here thinking, well, obviously that's not good, but I guess.
Well, obviously, I mean, you have to choose your battles.
It's and there are some. She has accepted.
Well, maybe that's good. It may be a little later. Yeah, I mean, obviously, you can't have the same amount of control over the input they're getting from the culture that you have when they were toddlers, and nor should you. They're getting older, and they need to start thinking about this themselves and making good decisions. But you can help. You can help your daughter not accept what she's hearing just carte blanche. You can use humor, you know. Pick out the messages in the TV ads, you know, make sarcastic comments. I just live for vacuuming, you know. The ads are ridiculous. Yes, yes. Ask her how she feels how women are depicted and tell her how you feel about it. It's good for girls to hear that their mothers are insulted by the degrading images of women. And it's also good that she hears this challenge from her father. His attitudes help shape her conceptions of male expectations. And if her dad values women, perhaps she can believe there are other guys out there who do, and she's worth waiting to find one of them. Next one, teach decision-making skills, especially about sex. Now, this is a hard one. And if your relationship with your child makes this too uncomfortable or even impossible to talk about this stuff, you might need the help of others, and we'll talk a little more about that later. But if your relationship is pretty open, talk to your daughters about sex. Tell her
there are many good reasons for waiting. Physical reasons, emotional reasons, relational reasons, future reasons, but most of all, spiritual reasons. Discuss biblical standards regarding sex. She's not going to hear these in school, and nor is she going to hear them from many of her peers. Rehearse how to deal with sexual advances. Predict the lines she'll hear. Dads can help with this one. And how to come back with a response. Moms can help with that one. Tell her what you remember about the pressures of your own adolescence. Help her make standards about sexuality in the cold, clear light of day. So she's got a plan, because it's going to come. And third, stay close with your daughter by directly inviting interaction and being available when she wants it, which is often going to be at the most inopportune time. I found that kids talk most when they're doing something else, like driving somewhere, playing, or eating, shopping, or working on something together. And they might choose to talk to you when you're already engaged in something else. Yes, I'm sorry. They do this because it diffuses the intensity of the conversation and puts it on a level that they can handle the amount of intimacy. You know. So if you want to talk about some of this stuff, take your daughter shopping or talk to her while you're folding the laundry. Do not say, let's sit down and have a serious talk about sex. She'll clam up for sure. Girls who do maintain closeness with their parents are more likely to hold on to their true selves, to avoid drugs and sex, and to achieve academically. I can think of two ways that my mom tried to keep close. For one, she used humor to monitor my behavior. Several times when I'd come in from a date, you know, the usual, how did it go, and all that. But then she'd say something like, Ruth, you don't let those guys check you out in the moonlight, do you? And we'd laugh together of how silly she could even think of such a thing. We both knew better. The second way she dealt with sexuality was to tell me that I could come to her no matter what. She said this explicitly to me. You know, Ruth, that if you ever got in trouble, that I would want you to tell me and I would help you. With these two brief comments, I got the message loud and clear that she expected me to have standards and that she thought I was capable of enforcing them. But I also knew that if I made mistakes, that I could go to her. And I think that my mother's belief in my ability to make these sexual decisions and her availability if I messed up were great moderators of the sexual pressures of my teen years. I think it was good for me to hear directly from her that I could come to her, because it was coming at a time when the culture was telling me to pull away. Finally, I'm calling this third strategy, casting a vision of what their lives can be. Girls who have an orientation toward the future are more likely to effectively negotiate the task of adolescence and to avoid its dangers. They know who they are and where they're going. This helps them avoid looking for identity or self-esteem in destructive ways such as appearance obsession or drugs or sex. And parents can have a great influence on a teen's goals. For example, research has shown that a parent's expectations of a teen's capabilities are better predictors of what the kid will go on to do than the kid's own past academic performance. So, in other words, a kid could have done really well in school and obviously have good talents, but if the parent's expectations are low, they don't have any vision for what they can do, they may not go on to realize those talents. One of the first ways you can do this is to expose them to the possibilities for their lives. In our tape with Rachel Delavorius, she got through adolescence with a love for music and a drive to perform the music she loved. And she had a course set because she was exposed to it early. For other girls, it might be sports or the outdoors or art. For many, it will be academics, especially if they have a sense that what they're studying will be connected to something meaningful later in their lives. But for girls to catch a vision of what their life can be, rather than the prescribed cultural course, they need to know what else is out there. When I went off to college, I knew two women in my life who
who worked outside the home, and they were both teachers, so I thought, oh, okay, I'll major in education. I had no exposure to the other possibilities of things I could do. So encourage them to try new things, to learn to sew or water ski, to backpack or paint, to join a sports or a debate team. For example, at the beginning of the school year, sit down with your daughter and look over the year's opportunities and help her think through which of these she might be able to do. Encourage her. Help her plan ahead. The more exposure she has to constructive activities, the greater her protection from destructive ones. This is because her time in the now is structured and her vision for the future is sharpened. And finally, and I think probably most importantly, is find mentors to model a vision. Many of the ideas I mentioned under teaching resistance can be integrated by a teen if they come from someone other than their parents. Girls might not be able to talk with their parents about how boys pressure them to have sex, but they might with an aunt or a youth worker or a counselor. So you might have thought it unrealistic to discuss this stuff with your daughters. Some of you could probably pull it off. Others will need the help of other adults. And I think it's especially important that girls have models of strong women. Women who love life, women who are comfortable with their own bodies, women who have a sense of calling or purpose. In short, women who love Christ and model his lordship in their lives. I can remember specifically in high school wishing that I had someone a little older than me to talk to. I remember trying to talk with a Sunday school teacher about drinking once, but I kept it on a real theoretical level because I didn't know her very well. I'm going to pilot a mentoring program this summer for just such a purpose. I'm going to take a small group of senior high girls from our church at first and expose them to Christian women from all walks of life, women who are mothers or grandmothers, women who are artists, lawyers, teachers, engineers, women who volunteer at crisis pregnancy centers. I hope that they're going to talk about their lives, their own adolescence, how they got involved, interested in, and trained for the work that they do, and above all, how they met Christ. I'm only telling you this to drive home how important I think it is for girls to have mentors. This is my effort at resistance because I'm tired of picking up the pieces after girls have started starving themselves, cutting themselves, or run away. We need more of this in the church. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. I'd much rather work with girls in my youth group than see them in my office. So take some time to think of your own ways to help the girls in your life. Think right now, who could spend some time with your daughter? It doesn't have to be anything official, like a mentor, but try and think of three names even. And then think of ways you could initiate such a relationship, perhaps by making a call, inviting that person to dinner, or hooking your daughter up with her on some kind of an outing. And for the women here, are there girls in your lives that you could mentor? Perhaps your nieces, or the daughters of your friends, or your own students. You are the resources those girls need. Your time, attention, and listening ear are part of the solution. And if there are more of you involved in the lives of girls, there'll be less of a need for me. And I think that would be a good thing. The world would probably be better off with fewer lawyers and psychologists. I want to close on a light note with another Randy Stonehill song that I think summarizes what we've been talking about today. It's called Barbie Nation.